Back at it for a midweek Wednesday, April 22nd on Connecticut Today. Following the coronavirus situation, we spoke to a local college professor who lived in several spots in Southeast Asia for a time. She talked about how the Southeast Asian various cultures and healthcare systems adapted to fighting COVID-19. We also aired parts of Governor Ned Lamont's daily COVID-19 briefing and the coronavirus and its effect on crude oil prices. An oil expert weighed in on that and what's ahead in the future. A lot of focus has been on China, Southeast Asia, nations like Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan, how they're doing, flattening the curves, what sort of warnings we got out of those nations above and around what China was saying. Joining us right now to kind of put this in perspective from Southern Connecticut State University, we have Professor Michelle Thompson, a professor of history. Professor, hi, Paul at WICC. How are you today?
At least it's a gorgeous day outside, if a little bit cool.
Yeah, we're all hunkered down here. Trying to get through this. What are your thoughts regarding generally, Professor, what we're seeing right now and how this whole thing has developed ostensibly out of China over the past, 3 or 4 months here? What are your basic thoughts?
Well, it really is very interesting. And because I lived in Taiwan for 4 years, and I lived in Hanoi, Vietnam for 2.5 years, and I've spent as much as 2.5 months on 3 or 4 occasions in Singapore. Mm-hmm. I'm really very interested in all of those places. I've kind of been keeping an eye on all of them. And it's really interesting that Taiwan has handled it very well. I mean, my friends who still live there told me back in January that they started taking precautions, that flights from China, people were being tested, people were being asked to self-quarantine, that schools, including universities, got an extended what is for them winter break. So for them, the Lunar New Year break is about like our Christmas and New Year's break. It's 2 to 3 weeks. So they took a month off. And they've contained it very well. Vietnam has also done really well, especially given the fact that it has a land border with China and just a tremendous amount of traffic back and forth between China. I mean, they had their first cases presented on January 23rd, three people who had returned from business trips to Wuhan. And they've been very, very aggressive about treating it. They've had, comparatively very, very low rate of people either coming down with it or needing hospitalization. But they've done some things that I haven't heard of any other country doing. For example, one big hospital in Hanoi just about 10 days ago came out of quarantine. The entire staff had been under quarantine after they handled patients. Mm. And they made them stay under 14 days of quarantine until every single staff member in the entire hospital had been tested negative 3 times.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that is that's some serious stuff. Professor, I wonder if, and this is kind of just wondering out loud on my part here, I wonder if that was done here, and of course hindsight, as you know, is always 20/20, but those are the kind of things here that I think if you start doing that at the outset here in the American culture, I don't think maybe we're used to that with our pride and personal liberties and any government's, any administration's desire kind of not to get people all riled up. You know what I mean? I don't know if that fits here. It'd be fascinating to find out, though.
Yeah, I don't know if it would fit here either. Plus, part of it was they didn't ever have any hospitals that got as completely overwhelmed with patients as a number of hours did in cities like New York. Even right now, what hospital in New York could you quarantine and say they can't accept new patients?
That's true. Yeah, that's a good point.
So part of it is just that whether by luck or by the very aggressive steps they took early on, and, I don't know the situation well enough to say what that is, they didn't ever have the situation where hospitals were getting completely overwhelmed and that they could not shut down one hospital to put it under quarantine.
Yeah, we continue a few more minutes with the history professor Michelle Thompson from Southern Connecticut State University. She has lived in the area off and on that is really on the front lines early on in the COVID-19 epidemic here. Professor, you said you lived in Taiwan some years, in Singapore as well. You know people in the area. Is there something in the psyche, the makeup? Is there a cultural thread, if you will, in those areas that is better suited to deal with something like this than we are as Americans or not?
I don't know whether there's something in the psyche in general, but I would have to say that in recent times, the four places that I mentioned before, Taiwan, Vietnam, Hong Kong, and Singapore, went through fairly recently, as epidemics go, just in 2003, they went through the SARS epidemic, which did not become a pandemic and didn't really affect the United States at all. But in terms of death rate, it was actually more deadly than this is. So not as many people got sick, but more people died. And I think the pretty recent memory of that makes a lot of people more responsive or more willing to go along with pretty rough quarantine measures. And so I think, you know, it's entirely possible that if we get some other completely different epidemic 10 years from now, people may remember this, and the American people may be more willing to accept really serious quarantine measures too. So I don't think it's something in the general psyche. I think it's something more like recent experience.
And it's interesting you mention that, because I've interviewed two or three very well-credentialed infectious disease folks here on this show, and they alluded to something you just did at the beginning, before we really knew how serious this was. A lot of scientists here look back at that SARS epidemic, and they just thought it was kind of a depressed or detuned version of SARS before they figured out, hey, wait a minute, something's not right here. And they said, well, those people went through it once, they could go through it again.
Yeah. I would say the world was, in a sense, lucky with SARS because it was, for whatever reasons, and, you know, I'm not a virologist. You could ask a virologist this. But for some reason, it was a virus that did not transmit person to person as quickly and as easily. Plus, it also, as far as I know, you were not infectious until you were actually showing symptoms. Whereas with this, you know, they're almost certain that before people have symptoms, they're infectious. So, you know, that meant that comparatively simple public health measures like isolating patients, trying to track their contacts, things like that, were a little bit easier and more effective in the SARS epidemic than they can be with this pandemic.
Talk a little about Taiwan. You said you lived there for a while. Professor, it's been very well documented now, as you well know, that Taiwanese and the scientists there were kind of, you know, sending up every piece of fireworks they could to say, hey, wait a minute, China's not being up front on this. Very well documented by the European press, not so much here in the States, that the Chinese influence apparently in the WHO was trying to muzzle Taiwan. Surprised by that or not? Is there that line of tension, obviously, between both governments here?
Well, China believes that when it speaks for Taiwan. It considers Taiwan to be part of China. So to them, that would be like the WHO listening to the state of New York rather than listening to the national government of the United States.
Yeah.
So am I surprised that they influenced the WHO to sort of ignore Taiwan? No.
But the continued, I guess, the jousting between both of these entities, obviously Taiwan and China, you know, that's been there for years. But I think that's been really magnified now in that situation. And I think one of the byproducts now is going to be maybe the entire world, the U.S., who knows, you know, Europe, you know, stepping back a little bit and, would you say, maybe reassessing as much as, you know, we're dependent on China for what they give us from a manufacturing base and all that. You think there's going to be some reassessment after this, Professor, or not?
I think there ought to be. Yeah. Whether there will be or not is a completely different question, and I'm not a prophet.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there ought to be some reassessment.
Yeah. Where do you think this goes for that area? Are these countries emerging, I don't want to say emerging powers, but in the future, in areas like this, do we listen maybe more to South Korea, who did a great job apparently at flattening the curve, to Singapore, to Taiwan, to South Vietnam, which is still emerging from the whole Vietnam era? Does this give them, you think, Professor, any new credibility on the world stage, or is that not necessary?
I think that allies ought to talk to each other, and that means they ought to listen to each other also. And all of the countries that you've just mentioned are now officially allies of the United States. Vietnam is an ally of the United States now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I certainly think that there ought to be more listening to these countries, you know, on the part of international organizations like the United Nations, like the WHO, and others, and on the part of our government.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As we wrap up, final thing. Tell my listeners one thing, one unique aspect that you discovered or found by living in this part of the world, which, you know, never mind living. I mean, many Americans don't even dream of visiting that part of the world. What is it? Give us one thing that you learned, and now you look back at this and you say to yourself, uh-huh, yep, I'm not surprised because of how they're able to deal with this. What do you think that might be? Well, what would you tell people?
I would say a willingness to work together rather than squabbling with each other internally within a country.
So it's kind of an all-hands-on-deck approach, and we can talk about this later.
When there's a really big problem, and I'm certainly not saying that these countries don't argue in that the people of these countries and the people in government in these countries don't argue with each other. They certainly do.
Yeah.
But it seems like they, at least in this instance, they all recognized a real external threat, and they did their best to cooperate with each other.
Interesting
internally.
Stuff. Interesting stuff. Fascinating stuff. History professor Michelle Thompson, Southern Connecticut State University. She's lived in the area, giving us a little bit of an inside aspect as to how Southeast Asia, even outside of China, has dealt with the COVID-19 outbreak. Professor, thank you. It's been fascinating. Hopefully we can chat down the line again. Stay safe. Be good. Thanks very much. Professor Michelle Thompson there.
Let me just do a quick look at our current numbers here. There's a bit of a catch-up here if you're wondering, hey, tests performed look like they're up a lot, positive cases up a lot. That reflects the fact that some of the tests came back. Deaths are still disturbingly high, and I'm tired of saying that reflects what happened 3 or 4 weeks ago. Hospitalizations, a little more current. That number continues to creep up, but still at a much slower pace than where we were a week or two ago, and that's really good news. Next slide, I think, is similar to what you've seen before. Fairfield County continues to be flat, well under control. New Haven is flat, under control. And Hartford continues to ramp up. One little tidbit on that before I go, I think I mentioned to you the How We Feel app, where we now have about 32,000 people, largest per capita in the country. Keep going. It gives us at least some information at this point. It's still small, but if you look at these numbers, it's sort of interesting to me that New London County is the county where, according to How We Feel app, you're most likely to social distance. Good going, New London. And you also have the lowest hospitalizations, or near the lowest. And Fairfield County, ironically, is the county where you're least likely to social distance. But even there, it's pretty good. Over half the people in Fairfield County social distance. Another interesting trait, I think, is mask wearing. Relatively new. Getting some feedback on that. New Haven is the county where you're most likely to wear a mask. Nice going, New Haven County. That's 32%. And Tolland County is the county where you're least likely, and they're not even registered on my total hospitalization. So much for that theory, but it's still interesting observations on what that means. The next chart reflects daily admissions. I don't like this that much because it's just a short-term look over the last 3 days. But again, you see Hartford ramping up the most. You see Fairfield went up just in the last day or so, probably a one-day spike, I'd like to believe. And New Haven went up. So those are things just to remind people that we still have work to do. And we still have this under control. We have our hospitals have capacity. The indicators are trending in the right direction. But we are by no means out of the ditch on this. And that's what we got to focus on. I want to just back up for 1 second because last night you probably saw that the Senate passed a large, what they call supplemental, a big bill that reflects about $400 billion. I was with Senators Murphy and Blumenthal today. They made the bill much better, especially the fact that it focuses on small, minority-owned businesses, gives them a better opportunity. And Glennon will be able to talk about that in a little bit. I also spent an hour with all my fellow governors. That'll just give you a perspective on how they look at things, how Connecticut looks at things, and how we square off on that. I think of most interest to all the governors, bipartisan, both sides of the aisle, they really wanted to see a supplemental, they wanted to see a money in there to pay back lost revenues at the state level. That didn't make it in the last bill. That was a big bill, $2.2 trillion a couple weeks ago. It didn't make it into this bill. And you may say, well, who needs it, governors? You got $150 billion in the last bill, and that's a lot of money. And that money pays for all the COVID-related expenses. They reimburse for those expenses. What that doesn't pay for, where the states are on their own, is the lost revenues. And in the state of Connecticut, where I'm most familiar, you know, we're looking at a deficit of about $500 million at the end of this fiscal year, June 30. And of that deficit, 85% of that is related to lost revenues. Maybe 10-15% is related to COVID-related expenses that aren't reimbursed. And the reason the lost revenues are so big is because, unlike the last recession, where income taxes went way down, but sales tax kept going. People continued to buy. In this recession, it's true of every state in the country. Not only have income taxes disappeared, but also so has sales tax. We were a little bit mitigated because of our sales tax on internet sales. And that's why a lot of the states are feeling a little desperate right now. And I could certainly hear that on the phone call. Governors thinking about having a special session of the legislature to slash spending or increase taxes. Governors talking about bills piling up on their desk, just a sense of urgency. And we're not in that position. As I've said before, thanks to a rainy day fund, thanks to a strong cash position, thanks to people being relatively conservative in our budgeting, we're in good shape, I believe, through this fiscal year, assuming no surprises. We'll see what happens, whether the states get any of the money in the next bill, the fourth supplemental, which will come up. The president in that bill is most interested in transportation infrastructure, as am I, as you know, ad nauseam. We talked about it for a year and a half. The president has also said that he'd be flexible or interested in taking a look at the $500 billion that the governors are looking for. The good news is he's given us a little bit of flexibility in the last revenues, so we can apply some of that perhaps to revenues. But the prospects of getting any more from the feds is cloudy at best. Mitch McConnell, the Republican who leads the Senate, where there is a majority, was not very happy about the idea of giving any additional money to the states. And he said if a lot of them are in trouble, maybe they should just think about filing for bankruptcy. Marie Antoinette said, let them eat cake. Mitch McConnell said, maybe let them file for bankruptcy. We'll see what happens on that, but I have a different philosophy. Rather than sit around complaining about what's going on in Washington, D.C., we're trying to focus here in Connecticut in terms of what we can do to mitigate things and take control of our own destiny. You know what we've done on the financial front in terms of rainy day fund and our cash position, which protects us at least for now. We spent a lot of time the last few days on testing, and there's a lot of complaints that they're not getting the testing ingredients and the swabs and the reagents from the federal government. Okay, so be it. But we've established some very strong corporate relationships, and that gives us a big advantage in terms of getting what we need to do the testing. You know, a few weeks ago, I talked to the CEO of CVS, Larry Merlot, said how important his relationship is for the state of Connecticut, what he can do with the Abbott Lab drive-through testing, one of the first states in the country, up and operating in New Haven with the necessary testing agents to get that done. You remember yesterday we had the CEO of Quest, the leading testing company probably in the country, a Connecticut guy by birth, and what he's able to roll out with Hartford Health to increasingly ramp up our testing, almost doubling it over the course of the next week. So anything I can do where I don't have to sit around blaming it on the Chinese or the national stockpile, we can take control. That's what we're trying to do. Today I was there at Battelle. I think I mentioned that to you. We're the seventh in the country Battelle Center where we will be able to sanitize 80,000 masks, N95 masks every day. And they've already done just a few hundred a day today, and that will ramp up very quickly. And we were on the phone with Battelle probably 2 weeks ago, and 2 weeks later, here we are. There are 60 other locations in the queue, and Connecticut is the seventh up and operating. So I think Connecticut should be proud of where we are, utilizing those relationships, doing whatever we can within our own capacity to add to our PPE stockpile, add to our surgical masks, and add to our testing and protect ourselves financially. You know, with that, I'd like to talk to you just briefly about the bill that passed last night. Tomorrow, it goes through the House of Representatives, where I believe it will pass as well. Really important. It provides another $75 billion for hospitals, not Connecticut hospitals, hospitals across the country. That's on top of the $100 billion they got in the first tranche. You know, of that $100 billion, only 30% of it has gone to our hospitals here in the state of Connecticut so far. So we're not out of the woods, but at least there's a sense of direction there. And over time, we can look at hospitals and how they can do some of the elective surgeries, which help get them standing on their own 2 feet. I think that's pretty good news. In addition, there's about $25 billion for testing. So we're going to be taking a look at that. Josh is taking the lead on a track and trace in ways we'll be able to get to the front of the line for some of those federal revenues. So we'll take what we can get. But the biggest thing they've done and really kept faith and are really proud is the fact that they kept faith with our small businesses. And in terms of another $320 billion, you remember that last tranche of small business, it was tapped out within about 10 days, 2 weeks. And Connecticut did pretty well. I mean, we got 18,000 loans done, about $225,000 on average per loan. That's about $4.2 billion. So we did pretty well compared to our region here. So thankful for the work of our banks, thanks for the work of DECD and all the small businesses that seized the opportunity. But we also have another 15,000 small businesses that got frozen out and didn't have enough in that pool to take care of them. So they'll be in the queue, and we'll be able to tell you a little bit, Glendalyn will, about what their status is. In particular, thanks to Senators Murphy and Blumenthal, we have a pretty good set aside, about $60 billion of that for small business, minority-owned business, women-owned business. I mean, I think you saw in that first tranche that a big restaurant chains like Shake Shack got a heck of a lot of money, and a lot of the small restaurants maybe did not get anything. And they're the folks we're fighting for. They're the folks that are on Main Street and don't have any other source of revenue to, you know, live off of. So with that, Glenda, how can we get those folks to the front of the line and make sure we get our share of this next tranche?
Thank you, Governor. Absolutely paramount. So during my time, I just want to focus on updating our small businesses and our residents relative to capital resources for small businesses during these unprecedented, challenging times. So we have done a business impact survey. So we did one initially during the first couple of weeks of COVID. And we have since done a second one that we launched next week. And so preliminary results, again, are continuing to show that overwhelming respondents are saying that access to capital and cash flow is paramount to them being able to sustain their business operations. So that said, the federal dollars that are coming down the pipe and re-upping essentially the first tranche of the CARES Act that the governor mentioned is paramount. So I just want to kind of provide some updates during my time relative to resources on the federal level, but also resources that are available at the state level. So there was significant improvements and reforms that were made through the second round of the federal funding that the governor mentioned. Businesses should be ready to apply for these dollars by as early as Thursday night or Friday morning. Two major improvements were focused and made through this last round. Again, a focus on minority-owned, rural, and underbanked businesses, as well as allowing farmers and agriculture enterprises to be eligible for the economic injury disaster loans, which they were not previously. So in the first round, as the governor mentioned, $4.2 billion was allocated to Connecticut, 18,000 loans here, which covers about 20 to 25% of our small businesses. So again, essentially, there's still a significant amount of small businesses here in our state that have not been able to access these dollars. But again, through the second round, we hope to change that. We have been trending on pace with what we would expect given our population size and GDP. And so again, but we just don't wanna keep pace and with our expectations, we wanna outperform. And so we've really been having a coordinated effort with our banks, with the SBA, to ensure that Connecticut businesses are accessing these dollars and getting their fair share. So the second round presents a new opportunity. $310 billion in additional lending authority for the Paycheck Protection Program. And of that, $60 billion is going to be set aside for smaller lenders. So those are lenders that have smaller deposits, your credit unions, your community financial institutions that are, you know, for all intents and purposes, in better positions to help minority-owned businesses, again, underbanked, who have traditionally been disproportionately impacted and have had barriers to accessing capital. And so a lot of those kind of loopholes were really kind of the focus of our federal delegation, as well as Congress with this next round. So we hope to see those adjustments and more dollars being accessible to those communities in this round. But again, it definitely is going to take a coordinated effort on the state's front and working in coordination with our credit unions and our banks. And I will say DECD is in close conversation with the Banking Association and the Connecticut Credit Union League as well to ensure that they're best positioned to access and make these dollars available to those communities and access those set-asides, if you will. The second piece is there's $60 billion for the SBA economic injury disaster loans. That's the EIDL program. Again, this was one of the first programs that was out there in the market from the feds before the PPP and other loans were available. This is getting re-upped essentially as well. So again, a total of $60 billion there. On a state level, I just want to kind of recap relative to the Connecticut Recovery Bridge Program. We are still on pace to ensure that we can deploy over 5,000 applications that we received and get those dollars to small businesses that are approved for those loans by the end of the month. We have our HEDCO Minority Business Initiative, which is the access to a line of credit up to $20,000 for woman-owned and minority-owned with a forgivable loan forgiveness feature. And again, those are for your smaller mom and pop Main Street businesses. So again, I encourage people to apply at www.headcoinc.com. And next, again, I just want to reiterate, there's a vast network of partners in our ecosystem here, the Connecticut Business Development Center, the Women's Development Business Development Center, the Spanish American Merchants Association, SAMA, just to name a few that are here and available to help you with technical assistance, but also ensure that you can apply, you understand these applications, and you're submitting complete applications. So again, there's opportunities there. We have our DECD hotline, 860-500-233, 860-500-233. Again, I encourage everybody to reach out to us. We have a dedicated team that is available and there to help businesses navigate through these very challenging times and connect you with the right resources. Last but not least, I think the main takeaway and call to action for small businesses is, again, if you have submitted an application, you have an application in that pipeline for PPP, immediately contact your bank and check on your status. If you haven't applied, please get in the queue and apply for these loans through your local bank, which could be an approved SBA lender, but check out that list on SBA.gov. Again, but get in the queue, get yourself ready. And in addition, I think this is important to understand and kind of share this information relative to alternative financial lenders that are online. So PayPal.com, QuickBooks.com, SquareUp.com, OnDeck.com, just to name a few, are online lenders that, again, is a real alternative if you do not have an existing banking relationship. You can easily access these through your smartphone or online and apply through those means and mechanisms efficiently and quickly through these programs. So I put that out there as an option to everybody, and this will be on our main coronavirus website as well. So with that, I will stop there and just tell everybody from a small business perspective, again, get in the queue, get geared up to be ready to apply for these loans as early as Thursday night or Friday morning. Thank you.
Speaking of coronavirus, look what it's done to the markets and the oil markets. Jeez, look, I don't know a heck of a lot about the oil market, but when I see that there's an oversupply, I guess, for the storage capacity, and oil is worth negative numbers, I don't know. Here's a guy who can hopefully explain that to us. He's with Shale Crescent USA, and our guest to try and explain it to folks like me who are kind of slow with this stuff, Greg Kozera is on the line. Greg, hi, Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you, sir?
Hey, good to be with you, Paul. Good stuff.
Well, Greg, wow, look, here's what I know. What I do know is oil is generally in a good economy, $60, $65. I know $75 is supposedly the line where if it goes over that's a signal the economy is overheating. If it stays under that, $40, $45, $50, okay. What the heck is going on now? Did I see oil earlier this week in the negative numbers?
You did, and I've been involved. Of course, we're economic development consultants, but we've been doing this for a long time, like 40-plus years. And, you know, I had to wrap my brain around a negative number. And what it really means is some of these people that are producing oil right now are actually paying people to take their oil away.
How do I get into that? How, can you get me into that? No, just...
It is. Well, and really, it's a... Now, today, I think it finished. I looked at the market. It's up around $16. But okay. What happened, it was really a short-term thing. It just happened because the oil being marketed today is for June delivery. So if you want oil in June, it's going to cost you $16 a barrel, which is really cheap anyways.
Yeah.
In May, and just to give you an example, your folks, you know, I heard the traffic report. There's not a lot of traffic out there. I normally drive between my wife and I. We have two cars, about 2,500 miles a month.
Okay.
We're going to drive about 250 this month.
That's amazing, right?
So you figure out all that gasoline that we would normally buy isn't going to be bought. And so you've got really what's happened is the people that were – they've got these contracts for oil that they got it being delivered, and it's like we got no place to put it. I mean, the refinery, there's – you know, nobody's buying it. So that's a real problem, and that's what happened. It was no place to store the stuff.
So,
and,
did I hear,
at
Greg,
the end of the
that
day, it's kind of a crazy thing that if you had a place to put the oil, what a deal! Can you imagine if you could sell, if you'd have bought that oil yesterday, if they'd have paid you $37 a barrel, and you can sell it in June for $16?
Oh,
I mean, if you
God.
Had a place to store that stuff, what a deal! You make a killing.
I can't put that much in my fridge, but it's a thought. but now, so Greg, in this scenario here. And I know, you know, it's, we do all the disclaimers when we give out, when we have our financial shows on this station, but are even in the midst of what we're dealing with here now, a deadly disease, you know, there are investors out there, whether it's real estate or stocks or whatever. I know a guy that bought, believe it or not, bought a cruise line stock for like $4 a share. He's like, what can I lose? Are there people sniffing around to buy all this cheap oil? Is that something you would say, hey, you know, if you're into that, now'd be the time to do it?
If you had a place, for instance, yesterday when it was minus numbers or even at zero, if you had a place to store it, and that could be maybe a tanker ship or something. I mean, this is when the numbers we're talking about. This is for the big boys. This isn't for someone like me that's, you know, doesn't work that way. But on the other hand, it speaks really of a bigger picture, Paul, of where we are, because when you shut the economy down across the world, it really is. A lot of these wells, you can't just shut the production down. If you do, the risk is you don't get it back to where it was. So they've got to keep producing. And in some cases, there's contracts that they have to meet, too. They have to meet a certain contract number. So that's – and the other thing that's really changed that a lot of your listeners may not be aware, you know – a lot of us remember the Arab oil embargo in the 70s and you know, even the energy crisis of the 90s and early 2000s, where we were dependent on OPEC and Russia and you know, Venezuela for our crude oil. And suddenly what's really changed is the United States going into this thing was the leading oil producer on the planet. And that just happened in the last 3-4 years. So that's been a big change, and that's one of the reasons why we're seeing gasoline prices as low as they were. Of course, now they're going to go even lower, I'm sure.
Maybe, you know, you're as old as I am. You remember the days when we used to have, you know, knives, steak knives, glasses, green stamps. Let's bring. Maybe you got to get the people back in the stations that way. You know, Greg, you touched on this. I heard yesterday that some companies are thinking, well, if this goes on, you know, we got to cap a well. What I do know is from watching documentaries and stuff and talking to other people, you just can't, as you mentioned, you just can't turn these wells on and off. Correct?
No, you can't. And in some cases, there's some that what they can do is, of course, because it's already happened earlier this year, because of the lower oil prices, people aren't drilling. So, you know, the one thing is that once you produce oil, it does, those wells start at a certain peak and they decline over time. So there'll be a natural decline over time, but it's going to take, this oil glut's going to be with us for a while until we really get the economy going. So, you know, if we were taking vacations now, I'd love to go to Disney World, but they're closed.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, I think this is one of those victims of the coronavirus. But here's what me as an economic development guy that's concerned about, because what's happening now, I mean, and the bigger picture of this whole thing is we need masks and gloves and ventilators. And really, you know, I just, you know, even with what I do, I didn't realize that 80% of our pharmaceuticals come from China.
Yeah.
Well, we got to change that. I mean, at the end of the day, I wouldn't buy dog food from China when we had our dog because I couldn't trust that some of it had glass in it.
Yeah.
So the pill I'm putting in my body, I mean, how do I really know? I can trust the FDA. I'm not sure I can trust the equivalent of it in China.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what worries me. We're getting all this stuff from China, and it's time to start bringing that back here. And believe it or not, we can do that now. We can actually manufacture in the United States cheaper than they can in China because we've got the energy here, oil, natural gas liquids. We've got the energy, and where you are, you're part of that. The largest economy in the world is the eastern northeast U.S. and eastern Canada, 50% of U.S. population, 70% of the Canadian population. If you're going to make stuff, this is the place on planet Earth to do it. And because we have cheap energy and modern manufacturing, artificial intelligence, robotics, remote control, all those things, we can compete very favorably with China in labor. I mean, it's a break even now. And so our goal really at this coronavirus thing, it's horrifying that we have to depend on someone outside of our country for gloves and masks and ventilators for our people, but our frontline healthcare workers. And we're really responding to that now across the country. And it's time. We can't let that happen ever again.
Is the oil business, the oil price, Greg Cozera, is that still one of the best indicators of what an economy is doing, you know, along with gold and the treasury bills and all that? Is that still a prime indicator in the year 2020?
I think it really is because, you know, that's what a lot of folks don't realize. It's not just the gasoline for our car, the diesel for the trucks or fuel in planes, or the gas grill out back or the, you know, the gas stove or the gas furnace. What oil is and what natural gas and natural gas liquids are that come with this is feedstock. I mean, that is the phones we're talking on, people's computers, TVs. If you look around your house or go to any big box store, most of the stuff in there is petrochemical based. It comes from an oil and gas well. It gets its start there somewhere.
Plastic.
And as long as we have those wells here in our country, that's the feedstock for everyday life. Even those those pharmaceuticals, that's chemicals and that's petrochemical based. Most of that stuff. So, you know, if we have to depend on OPEC for those feedstocks for our stuff, whether it's petrochemicals or cell phones or, you know, clothing, athletic shoes, all that stuff, that's a bad thing. I mean, we really, there's so much stuff that we're getting from China that it's time that we started making that here so we don't have to depend on them when things get tough.
The website is Shale Crescent USA. Greg, before we let you go, explain what your organization does.
Sure. What we're doing, West Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, that's where the Utica and Marcellus are. It's right now, that's where the growth in natural gas supply is in the United States. And our role as nonprofit, non-government, is to let the world know that that's also the cheapest place, the old Rust Belt, where you can bring manufacturing now and be on top of your feedstock and in the middle of this customer base that you guys are part of and I'm part of and the people in Canada are. So what we're trying to do is bring industry back there. And our whole goal is to create high-wage jobs and create that modern economy that'll raise the prosperity of the people there.
Check it out, ShaleCrescentUSA.com. Greg Cozera, great insights. Greg, take care of yourself. Thank you, and hopefully we'll talk in the future. Thank you.
Please. Thanks for all you do, Paul. Good stuff.
Thanks. Appreciate it, Greg.